Chapter 3. Chip and Winthrop. The only problem was that since I was such a poor student, every university I applied to rejected me. Only after the intervention of my high school guidance counselor did I get a place at the University of Colorado in Boulder on appeal. While barely getting into Boulder was humiliating, I recovered pretty quickly when I realized the school had been ranked as the number one party school in the country by Playboy magazine. Based on countless viewings of the movie Animal House, I decided that if I was going to go to a party school, I might as well do it right and join a fraternity. I pledged the Delta Epsilon fraternity, and after the requisite hazing, was accepted as a member. Everyone had a nickname there: Sparky, Whiff, Doorstop, Slim, and mine, on account of my curly black hair, was Brillo. Being Brillo was fun, but after a few months of too much beer, chasing girls, ridiculous pranks, and watching countless hours of sports on TV, I started to think that if I kept it up, then the only kind of capitalist I was going to be was the kind who collected tips as a parking attendant. It all came to a head when one of my fraternity brothers, and someone I idolized, was caught robbing the United Bank of Boulder to fund an out-of-control coke habit. After he was sentenced to a long stretch in federal prison, I had something of a wake-up call. I realized that if I kept it up, then the only person who would suffer from this particular form of rebellion would be me. From that moment forward, I stopped partying, spent every night in the library, and began to get straight A's. At the end of my sophomore year, I applied to top universities around the country and was accepted to the University of Chicago. I worked even harder at Chicago, and my ambition grew. But as I approached graduation, I felt an overriding need to figure out what I was going to do with my life. How was I going to go about being a capitalist? As I mulled this over, I came across an announcement for a lecture by the dean of the graduate business school. Since my plan was to go into the business world in some capacity, I decided to attend. The speech he gave was about the career paths of Chicago MBA graduates, all of whom seemed to be doing important things and getting paid well to do them. Business school, it seemed, was the obvious next step for me. The best way to get accepted at one of the top business schools was to get into one of the two-year pre-MBA programs at McKinsey or Goldman Sachs, or at one of the 25 other firms with similar programs. I bombarded all of them with letters and phone calls asking for a job. But of course, it wasn't so simple as that. It wasn't so simple because every other college senior with similar ambitions was doing the exact same thing. In the end, I received 24 rejection letters, along with a single offer from Bain & Company in Boston, one of the top management consulting firms in the country. It wasn't clear how I'd slipped through its filter, but somehow I had, and I grabbed its offer with both hands. Bain chose students with top grades from good schools who were ready to work 16 hours a day, 7 days a week for 2 years. In return, they promised you would get into one of the top business schools. There was a rub that year, though. Bain's business was growing so quickly that they needed to hire 120 smart student slaves instead of just 20, like all the other firms running two-year pre-MBA programs. Unfortunately, this ruined the implicit deal Bain had with the business schools. These schools did indeed like to admit young consultants from Bain, but they also liked McKinsey, Boston Consulting Group, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, and dozens of other sweatshops for ambitious young capitalists. So, in the best case, these schools would accept only 20 people from Bain, not the full 120. In essence, Bain was offering the opportunity to work your fingers to the bone for $28,000 a year, and your reward was a 16% chance, at best, of getting into Harvard or Stanford. The resulting business school application process created a crisis for all of us at Bain. We eyed each other suspiciously for weeks, trying to figure out how we were going to differentiate ourselves from one another. I certainly wasn't better than my classmates. Many had gone to Harvard, Princeton, or Yale, and many had better performance reviews than me at Bain. But then it dawned on me, my colleagues may all have had better resumes, but who else was the grandson of the leader of the Communist Party of the United States? No one else, that's who. I applied to two schools, Harvard and Stanford, and told them my grandfather's story. Harvard was quick to reject me, but amazingly, Stanford said yes. I was one of only three Bain employees accepted to Stanford that year. In late August 1987, I packed up my Toyota Tercel and drove across the country to California. When I got to Palo Alto, I turned right off El Camino Real onto Palm Drive, which led up to Stanford's main campus. The road was lined with twin rows of palm trees, ending at Spanish-style buildings with terracotta roofs. The sun was shining, and the sky was blue. This was California, and I felt as if I were arriving in heaven. I soon learned that it was heaven. The air was clean, the sky was brilliant, and every day felt as if I were living in some kind of paradise. Everyone at Stanford had killed himself to get there, working 80-hour weeks at sweatshops like Bain, poring over spreadsheets, falling asleep at their desks, sacrificing fun at the altar of success. We were all strivers who had competed against one another for the right to be there. But once we got there, the whole paradigm shifted. Stanford didn't allow you to show your grades to potential employers. All hiring decisions were made on the basis of interviews and past experience. The upshot of this was that the normal academic competition was replaced with something that none of us expected, an air of cooperation, camaraderie, and friendship. I quickly realized that success at Stanford wasn't in doing well there, but rather just being there. Everything else was gravy. It was for me and for every one of my classmates the best 2 years of our lives. Aside from just enjoying the experience, the other purpose of Stanford was to figure out what to do after business school. From the moment we arrived, my classmates and I spent nearly every day going to corporate information sessions, brown bag lunches, evening receptions, dinners, and interviews, trying to choose which job among thousands available was the right job. I went to a standing room only Procter & Gamble brown bag lunch and watched three female junior marketing executives in pleated blue skirts, white shirts, and floppy ties talk in excited corporate jargon about all the fantastic ways they sold soap. I went to a Trammell Crow cocktail reception. I felt so out of place that it curled my toes in my shoes as smooth-talking, good-looking Texans slapped each other on the back and shot the shit about baseball, big money, and real estate development, which was Trammell Crow's business. Then there was the Drexel Burnham Lambert reception where I tried to stay awake as a team of balding bond salesmen with fancy suits droned on about the thrilling world of high-yield bond trading in their Beverly Hills office. I thought, no, no, and no thank you. The more I went to these things, the more out of place I felt, and one interview in particular drove it home. It was for a summer associate job at J.P. Morgan. I didn't particularly want to work there, but how could I not interview for a job at J.P. Morgan, one of the top firms on Wall Street? I went into a small room at the Career Management Center and was greeted by two tall, square-jawed, broad-shouldered men in their early 30s. One was blonde, the other brown-haired, and both wore monogrammed button-down shirts, dark Brooks Brothers suits, and red suspenders. As the blonde one thrust his hand forward, I noticed an expensive-looking Rolex. They each handed me their business card from a small stack on the desk. Their names were something like Jake Chip Brandt III and Winthrop Higgins IV. The interview began with the most standard question, why do you want to work at J.P. Morgan? I considered answering, because you invited me and I need a summer job, but I knew that's not what I was supposed to say. Instead, I said, because J.P. Morgan has the best attributes of an investment and commercial bank, and I think that combination is the most compelling formula for success on Wall Street. I thought, did I really just say that? What the hell did that even mean? Chip and Winthrop didn't like my answer either. They carried on with some more standard questions, and I batted them back with some more similarly insipid answers. Winthrop finished with a softball question, offering me a way to find some common ground. Bill, can you tell us what sports you played in college? This was an easy one. I hadn't played any sports in college. I was such a nerd that I barely had time to eat and go to the bathroom, let alone play a sport. I said flatly, well, none really, but I like skiing and hiking, hoping that those sports were cool enough for these two guys. They weren't. Neither Chip nor Winthrop said another word or bothered to look up on the stack of resumes. Interview over. As I walked out of the building, I realized that these guys didn't care what I said. All they wanted to determine was whether I fit the J.P. Morgan culture. I clearly didn't. I made my way to the cafeteria feeling awkward and dejected. I stood in line, got some food, wandered to a table, and ate distractedly. As I finished my sandwich, my best friend, Ken Hirsch, walked in wearing his suit, which was a sign that he too had just gone to some job interview. Hey, Ken, where have you been? I asked. He pulled out a chair. Just interviewed with J.P. Morgan. Really? You must have met Chip and Winthrop, too. How'd it go? Ken laughed at my nicknames and shrugged. Not sure. It wasn't going very well until I told Chip that he could use my polo ponies at the club in the Hamptons. Things turned around very nicely from there. Ken smiled. He was a short, middle-class Jewish guy from Dallas, Texas. The closest he'd ever been to polo ponies was seeing them on the Ralph Lauren logo at the Galleria Mall in Dallas. How about you? This is the same Ken Hirsch who went on to run Natural Gas Partners, one of the most successful energy private equity firms in the world. You and I'll be working together then. I know I'll get the job for sure since I told Winthrop I'd take him sailing on my skiff at the Kennebunkport Yacht Club. Neither Ken nor I got an offer, but from that day forward, Ken called me Chip, and I called him Winthrop. After the J.P. Morgan experience, I couldn't stop wondering why I subjected myself to being rejected by the Chips and Winthrops of the world. I wasn't like them, and I didn't want to work for them. I had chosen this direction in life in reaction to my parents and my upbringing, but I couldn't escape the fact that I was still a Browder. I then started looking for jobs with some type of personal relevance. I went to a lecture by the head of the United Steelworkers Union and loved it. As I listened to him talk, I heard the voice of my grandfather, a man with white hair and a mustache whom I fondly remembered sitting in his study, surrounded by books, the sweet smell of pipe tobacco infusing everything. I was so inspired that after the speech, I approached the man and asked if he would hire me to help the union negotiate with its exploitative corporate employers. He thanked me for my interest, but said that they employed only steelworkers in the union's head office. Undeterred, I looked at other aspects of my grandfather's life that I might emulate and came up with the idea of Eastern Europe. He had spent an important part of his life in the Soviet bloc, and his experience there had catapulted him into global significance. If that's where my grandfather had carved out his niche, then maybe I could too. In the midst of this soul-searching, I had also started lining up real job offers in the event that my search for utopia didn't bear fruit. One was with the Boston Consulting Group in its Midwest headquarters in Chicago. I was from Chicago and had worked in consulting at Bain, which meant that I checked all the right boxes for its new recruits. Only I didn't want to go back to Chicago. I wanted to get out and see the world. More than that, I wanted to work in the world. What I really wanted was to be Mel Gibson in The Year of Living Dangerously, my favorite movie. In an effort to get me to accept its offer, BCG flew me to Chicago for a selling day, where I was joined by other recruits. We were subjected to meeting after meeting with bright-eyed first and second-year consultants who regaled us with tales of their exciting lives at BCG. It was nice, but I wasn't buying it. My last meeting was with the head of the office, Carl Stern. This was meant to be the end of the process, where I would shake the big man's hand, thank him profusely, and say, yes. When I entered his office, he said warmly, "So, Bill, what do you think? Will you join us? Everyone here likes you a lot." I was flattered, but there was no way I could accept. "I'm really sorry. Your people have made me feel very welcome. But the fact is, I can't see myself living and working in Chicago." He was a bit confused, since I hadn't voiced any objections to Chicago during the interview process. "It's not BCG, then?" "No, not exactly." He leaned forward. "In that case, please tell me. Where would you like to work?" This was it. If I really could go anywhere, I might as well tell him. "Eastern Europe." "Oh," he said, clearly caught off guard. Nobody had told him that before. He leaned back in his chair and looked at the ceiling. "Let me think. Yes. As I'm sure you know, we don't have any offices in Eastern Europe. But there's someone in our London office who specializes in that area named John Lindquist. We can arrange for you to meet him if you think that might change your mind." "It might. Great. I'll figure out when he's available, and we'll arrange it for you." 2 weeks later, I was on my way to London.